number two. For 2 months now, the Falklands crisis has dominated the news. Likewise, the growing threat of nuclear war and mounting anti-nuclear sentiment have been making headlines. But for millions of Americans, a different crisis seems far more important. It is a long-term crisis which has been with us for many years now. This mounting crisis, my friends, is that of the crumbling United States economy and the United States dollar. Just this month, May 1982, there has been all sorts of bad news on the economic front. On May 7, the government announced that unemployment, as officially calculated, had reached 9.4%, the highest level since the Great Depression. And just 5 days later, there was another shock. Braniff Airlines abruptly terminated operations and filed for bankruptcy. It was the first time ever that a United States trunk airline had failed. Braniff, like more and more other businesses, was brought down by a mountain of debt. With interest rates remaining sky high in the midst of a deep recession, more and more companies simply cannot survive. Production cutbacks, layoffs, and bankruptcies are continuing to spread, and more people are losing their jobs. This recession is especially cruel because it is an inflationary recession. We're now living in the stagflation era, which I warned about in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, nearly 10 years ago. The deliberate plans, which were set in motion long ago, to destroy the United States dollar are now far advanced. Since 1970, the combined effects of inflation and taxes have cut the purchasing power of the dollar by 55%. A family of four living on $10,000 in 1970 would need well over $23,000 in 1982 just to stay even. And this historically unprecedented collapse of the dollar is continuing, even as people are thrown out of work. For months now, the battle over the federal budget has been dragging on day in, day out. We're told constantly that the budget is the key to bringing down the incredible interest rates that are killing the economy. And yet, somehow it seems that no one can agree about what the budget should be. One budget proposal after another has come up for consideration, only to be voted down. First, there was the Reagan administration budget, which went nowhere. Then all kinds of alternative budgets started being proposed. There have been Republican budgets, Democrat budgets, conservative budgets, liberal budgets, compromise budgets, and every single budget proposed so far has been voted down. There is more and more talk that the federal budget process has gone sour, that there is something fundamentally wrong. On May 28th, the entity President Reagan denounced the budget process while he was in Santa Barbara, California, to make a speech. He said, quote, "The United States government's program for presenting a budget or arriving at a budget is about the most irresponsible Mickey Mouse arrangement that any governmental body has ever practiced. It's called the President's budget, and yet there is nothing binding about it. It is submitted to the Congress, and they don't even have to consider it," unquote. My friends, please note carefully how this criticism by the President was phrased. I suggest you stop your recorder and play it back again, because the entity Reagan was not just delivering a standard political tongue-lashing at his political opponents. He was condemning the process itself. And he added, quote, "I think that some real solid thinking should be given now to a budgeting process that befits the great government of a great nation," unquote. My friends, Reagan's choice of Santa Barbara, California, for this statement was symbolic. It so happens that the so-called solid thinking he recommended for a new budgeting process has already been done. And as the President knows very well, that thinking was done in Santa Barbara at a tax-exempt foundation called the Center for Study of Democratic Institutions. That is where the secret new Constitution for America was written, including detailed new provisions for the budgeting process. 7 years ago, in 1975, I published a pamphlet in which I reviewed the secret new Constitution from a legal perspective. The entire text of the new Constitution is contained in the pamphlet. If you have a copy, you can read about the proposed new budget process for yourself. It's all there in black and white. Important passages to look at include Article 4, the Planning Branch, Sections 2, 4, and 7, Article 5, the Presidency, Section 1, and Article 6B, the House of Representatives, Section 8. What you will discover if you trace through the budget process described in the new Constitution is very significant. When all the legal-sounding mumbo-jumbo is stripped away, the whole budget process turns out to be firmly under the thumb of the President. For example, Reagan complained in Santa Barbara that the President's budget, quote, is submitted to the Congress and they don't even have to consider it, unquote. My friends, the secret new Constitution would fix that. Article 6B, Section 8 begins, quote, the House shall consider promptly the annual budget, unquote. What's more, the House is given no role in formulating the budget. If they dare to object to anything, the budget goes back to the planning board, so-called, controlled by, you guessed it, the President. The Reagan blast about the budget process is just the latest of an ongoing series of covert moves to pave the way for the new Constitution. What makes this one more significant is that it is tied in with powerful economic forces which are intended to speed up the process. Through months of contrived haggling, the kept Congress has been sensitizing Americans to the budget problem, and they have been doing it at a time when uncertainty over the budget is being blamed for worsening economic woes. Now, along comes the President saying that the solution is to change the whole process. The growing budget crisis is also tied in with another major change, which the entity President Reagan has been publicly advocating. That change, my friends, is the proposed balanced budget amendment to our present United States Constitution. There is a drive underway right now to call a constitutional convention in order to introduce a balanced budget amendment. Already, most of the required number of states have ratified the call for such a convention. At the moment, if just three more states ratify it, a constitutional convention will be legally required to be called. The excuse for calling a constitutional convention would be to introduce the balanced budget amendment. The problem is that once a convention is called, there's no way to keep it from turning into a runaway convention, rewriting the entire Constitution. In fact, that's exactly how our present United States Constitution was created. The original idea was to simply amend the Articles of Confederation. But once the convention was through, a totally new constitution emerged. Those who are behind the drive for a new constitutional convention now want the same thing to happen again. And if it does, they have their model for a carefully manicured dictatorship constitution ready to go. In the past, there have been several other drives like the present one to call a constitutional convention. Each has been built around some pet idea of one kind or another. But each time the drive has fizzled out. Enough people have recognized the danger of a runaway constitutional convention to prevent its happening. This time, though, the danger is much greater than ever before. Because this time, the excuse for the proposed convention is tied directly to people's pocketbooks. We're being told by various financial spokesmen on television that high interest rates are responsible for our economic woes, which is a half-truth. We are also told that government deficits are responsible for keeping those disastrous interest rates high. Then we are treated to the spectacle of a government seemingly unable to decide on a budget. And finally, whenever a budget is passed, it will contain the biggest deficits in history, well over $100 billion. Against that background, The promise of relief by way of the balanced budget amendment may prove too tempting to resist. If so, the drive to call a constitutional convention will succeed. And in the process, we Americans will have sold our birthright for a mess of pottage. My friends, although this may sound almost irrelevant right now in view of the specter of possible nuclear war by the end of summer, but never forget that the plans for war are the plans of men, nothing more. Those plans have a way of going awry in many cases, and in the case of those nuclear war plans, feverish attempts are underway to make them go awry. The Bolshevik war planners who control the Pentagon want nuclear war, but their anti-Bolshevik enemies who now rule Russia don't want war and are trying to prevent it. Likewise, the Rockefeller cartel here in America is in a power struggle against the Bolsheviks in an attempt to stop the war plan. If the Rockefeller interests do succeed in regaining control of the United States government, they plan to stop the Bolshevik war countdown. But the Rockefeller group are fighting this battle only for themselves, my friends, not for you or me. It is they who are behind the secret new constitution and the drive for a constitutional convention. If they succeed in beating the Bolsheviks here, they intend to capitalize. With their secret new constitution, they plan to bring us under their domination more completely than ever before. In audio letter 72, 3 months ago, I reported that a military coup d'etat was in gestation here in Washington. This is to be a coup by the Rockefeller cartel operatives within the government against Bolshevik operatives. The man in charge is a 4-star general, Alexander Haig. Up to now, the anti-Bolshevik coup has not been accomplished, but it is gaining ground. One major gain for the Rockefeller faction occurred last month, while all eyes were on the Falklands crisis. On April 21, it was announced that Admiral Bobby Inman, Deputy Director of the CIA, had resigned, quote-unquote, effective immediately. Inman was forced out by the Rockefeller faction. He was replaced with lightning speed by John McMahon, a career professional with the CIA. It was the Rockefellers who created the CIA long ago as their own private detective agency. And now they are working fast to reestablish the control which they lost over the CIA 3 years ago. The infighting between the Rockefeller and Bolshevik factions within the government is growing more intense as the war fuse burns shorter and shorter. President Reagan and Secretary Haig are both under tight security. This summer of 1982 will be dangerous for them and for America. Topic number 3. On the evening of May 16, millions of Americans tuned their television sets to NBC to watch the first installment of a special miniseries. It was a lavish portrayal of the travels and adventures of Marco Polo. For the next 4 nights, viewers were treated to a spectacular reenactment of Marco Polo's experiences as he traveled to China. Interspersed with those scenes of adventure and splendor were brief scenes depicting what happened to Marco Polo after he returned home to Venice. He dared to speak of places he had been and things he had seen that conflicted with the dogma of the day, and so he was tried for heresy. Today, in 1982, we like to think of ourselves as too enlightened to close our minds like the inquisitors of Marco Polo. But the fact is that even today, those who challenge preconceived notions are quickly branded as heretics and the like. There was a perfect example of this on Sunday morning, May 16. Ironically, it was the same day as the beginning of the Marco Polo series. My friends, I'm referring to the interview of evangelist Dr. Billy Graham on the ABC News program This Week with David Brinkley. Dr. Graham had just returned to England from participating in a 5-day religious conference in Moscow, Russia, of all places. He was one of more than 400 religious leaders from 80 nations who attended the conference. They were there at the invitation of the Russian Orthodox Church, which sponsored the conference. A large fraction of those who attended were Christian leaders, such as Dr. Graham. But there were also many representatives of the world's other great religions. They were not there to convert, to compete, or to condemn one another. Instead, it was a rare opportunity for these leaders to form bridges of mutual understanding, something which is all too often neglected in our world. It was a religious conference the likes of which the world has not seen for more than 80 years. The last time anything like this took place was before 1900. It was held here in America, in Chicago, and it was called the Parliament of Religions. There were some who feared that historic meeting of the minds and have condemned it ever since. As a result, it has never been repeated here in America. But I submit, my friends, that those fears were groundless. The Parliament of Religions did not destroy Christianity or turn Americans overnight into Buddhists, Muslims, or Hindus. What it did do was to establish bonds of understanding and respect for a while where they had been lacking before. My friends, it is a psychological fact that it is usually hard to hate another person if you get to know him. That is why any government bent on war tries to dehumanize and depersonalize the enemy. From the turn of the century onward, the United States government has been controlled by elements who cherish war as an instrument of policy. So we see no more parliaments of religion here in America. By contrast, the government of Russia has undergone a drastic transformation in recent years. Russia's new rulers are Christians, as I have been reporting for nearly 5 years. After an agonizing struggle of 6 decades, these tough native Russians have finally gained the upper hand over the satanic Bolsheviks there. Over 3 years ago, the growing power of the Kremlin Christians started producing startling changes in public. For example, for Easter 1979, Handel's Messiah was performed in Russia for the very first time since the Bolshevik Revolution. And several months before that, in January 1979, the first legal shipment of Bibles into Russia since 1917 had taken place. The American Bible Society had asked the Russian government for permission, and it had been granted. In Audio Letter 44 over 3 years ago, I issued an appeal to America's Christian leaders to take a stand for peace before it was too late. What I suggested was a pilgrimage for peace to Moscow. Its purpose would have been to begin new ties of trust and understanding with the new Christian rulership of Russia. In that way, America's churchmen had the opportunity to take the initiative in a concrete way to help head off nuclear catastrophe. The response, as I reported later, was pathetic. To the everlasting shame of America's Christian community, only a tiny handful of Christian leaders expressed any interest at all. The Christian leaders of America, by and large, refused to hold out the hand of Christian fellowship to their brothers in Russia. But now, a pilgrimage for peace has been made to Moscow after all. Since America's Christian leaders would not bother to take the initiative, those of Russia did so instead. They invited religious leaders the world over to make a pilgrimage for peace to Moscow, and they called their 5-day assembly the, quote, Conference of Religious Workers for Saving the Sacred Gift of Life from Nuclear Catastrophe, unquote. When Billy Graham and some other Western Christian leaders arrived in Moscow, they soon discovered that it was not as they had been led to expect. Dr. Graham discovered that there was no attempt to restrict him in his religious messages. He was also allowed more freedom of movement than he had expected. On the Saturday evening before the conference began, Dr. Graham decided to pay unannounced visits to several Moscow churches. He went to 3 different Russian Orthodox churches and was shocked to find that they were filled to capacity with worshipers. As he said later in a news conference, quote, "You would never get that in Charlotte, North Carolina," unquote. Dr. Graham made a number of statements about his experiences in Moscow, which all seem to add up to one thing. There is a lot more Christian worship going on in Russia than he apparently expected, and with greater freedom. When Billy Graham returned to the West, he must have felt a little like a religious Marco Polo. He had journeyed to the Forbidden East and discovered that it is not populated by gremlins and horrible beasts. Instead, he had come away with his heart strangely warmed, quote-unquote. Perhaps he expected that the folks back home would welcome his unexpected good news. After all, our whole Christian faith is built on good news, the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. But if that is what Billy Graham expected, he was sadly mistaken. When he returned to the West, he came back not to people eager to hear more of his good news, but to hostility and condemnation. We're always told that Russia is an atheistic country and beyond redemption. And so, by definition, Billy Graham's words about even limited religious freedom in Russia constituted heresy. He ran into a buzzsaw of critics determined to cut him down for saying a good word about Russia. He began right away with slanted reports about his statements in the major media. At one point, Dr. Graham mentioned that in Russia, his comments have been reported accurately in the press. By contrast, reports here in the United States were distorted and quoted him out of context. A perfect example of the treatment now being given Dr. Graham was his May 16 interview on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. It was called an interview, but inquisition would be a better description. Every suggestion that Christians may be better off in Russia today than in the past was met with hostility. Time after time after time, Dr. Graham was interrupted and attacked before he could even finish making his point. And many of the questions in the best tradition of heresy trials were designed to declare Graham guilty before he could even answer. To take just one example, at one point the ideological writer George F. Will mentioned an incident in which a peace protester was subdued by Russian police. Then he asked, and this is an exact quote, "Given that evidence that there is no and is not about to be any peace movement in the Soviet Union, wasn't it clear to you from the start that this propaganda festival to which you were going was used simply to encourage a unilateral peace pressure and disarmament pressure in the West?" Unquote. My friends, a so-called question like that is the tool of a prosecutor, not an objective reporter. In one breath, he claimed that there is no peace movement in Russia as if it were a fact, accused Dr. Graham of knowingly cooperating in Soviet propaganda, implied that all the world religious leaders who attended were stooges, and ignored the worldwide representation at the conference, saying it was all aimed at the West. Accusing questions like that were fired at Dr. Graham throughout the program. The only break in this inquisition came when Dr. Graham was removed from the discussion for a while. Then everyone else sat around and ripped him up one side and down the other in his absence for his heresies. In spite of the grossly unfair treatment, Reverend Graham made some very telling points. He mentioned that many other American Christian leaders were also at the Moscow conference, and that still others have gone there separately. And he said there are many, quote, that would hold different viewpoints than what is being expressed here today. I'm a little surprised that we don't have some of those people, unquote. Perhaps Dr. Graham's most telling comment came fairly early in the program. Perhaps it was partly responsible for the frenzied bitterness of some of the attacks on him later in the program. Reverend Graham said, and I quote, "Now, when people go to China today, for example, they are applauded for going to China. It's wonderful to go to China. But there is not as much religious freedom in China as there is in the Soviet Union," unquote. My friends, Billy Graham was exactly right in that statement. I have reported the same thing in my audio letter reports. The favorable image now being given to Red China is purely political and military in its origins. Unfortunately, some church-related groups are being used for these political purposes. What Dr. Graham may not know is the reason for the violent attacks he has endured lately. My friends, he has run afoul of the American Bolshevik nuclear war lobby here. They want to use you and me to do their dirty work for them against Russia. That is what their nuclear war plans are all about. And so at all costs, they must not let us know that Christianity is reviving today in Russia. Even more, they dare not let the American people know that the true leadership of Russia today is Christian. Because if we all knew that, my friends, we would never agree to their plans to destroy Christian Russia in a thermonuclear war. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I've tried to bring you up to date on the progress of plans to throw America into nuclear war against Russia. The countdown by the Bolshevik war planners who now control the Pentagon is still continuing. Their war plans have been damaged by the Falklands War, but they are trying to turn that conflict to their own ends. Meanwhile, the countdown for Space Shuttle Flight No. 4, with its secret military payload, is still on schedule. If the mission succeeds, the danger of nuclear war will increase dramatically. The summer of 1982, my friends, promises to be a dangerous time for America. As of now, nuclear war one could be as little as 3 months away. But the Bolsheviks here have enemies who are trying to stop the war countdown. Here in the United States, the Rockefeller cartel is continuing its power struggle to take back control of the government from the Bolsheviks. As part of that struggle, the preparations for a military coup d'etat led by General Alexander Haig are making progress. Likewise, the Russians are continuing to try in their own ways to prevent the war. Unlike the Rockefeller cartel, the Russians are doing this for moral reasons. This month, May 1982, religious leaders from around the world gathered in a religious conference to take a stand for peace. If the conference had been held, say, in Washington, D.C., we would be hearing nothing but praise about it. But it was held instead in Moscow, Russia, and for that reason alone, it has been condemned here in the United States. Those who dare to honestly report the favorable surprises they encountered there are being castigated as heretics. The most visible of these is Reverend Billy Graham. For describing what he actually saw and experienced, honestly and without prejudice, he is being crucified on all sides. My friends, the same thing will happen to you if you dare to speak up about the things you know. But if you do not speak up to your friends, to your neighbors, to your relatives, they may never know why we are heading toward nuclear catastrophe. So I urge you to speak now and remember the promise of our Lord Jesus Christ. He said, "Blessed are they who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.